Text 20, the continued prayers by the living entity, the soul. It's within the womb of a human form of life, human mother. By evolution, soul may come to that position, and this is a very special one, Krishna conscious one. I read the translation. Therefore, my Lord, although I am living in a terrible condition, I do not wish to depart from my mother's abdomen to fall again into the blind well of materialistic life. Your external energy, called Deva Maya, at once captures the newly born child and immediately false identification, which is the beginning of the cycle of continued birth and death, begins. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. As long as the child is within the womb of his mother, he is in a very precarious and horrible condition of life. But the benefit is that he revives pure consciousness of his relationship with the Supreme Lord and prays for deliverance. But once he is outside the abdomen, when a child is born, Maya, or the illusory energy, is so strong that he is immediately overpowered into considering his body to be his self. Maya means illusion, or that which is actually not. In the material world, everyone is identifying with his body. The false egoistic consciousness of I am this body at once develops after the child comes out of the womb. The mother and other relatives are waiting the child, and as soon as he is born, the mother feeds him and everyone takes care of him. The living entity soon forgets his position and becomes entangled in bodily relationships. The entire material existence is entanglement in this bodily conception of life. Real knowledge means to develop the consciousness of I am not this body, I am spirit soul, an eternal part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. Real knowledge entails renunciation or non-acceptance of this body as the self. Second paragraph. By the influence of Maya, the external energy, one forgets everything just after birth. Therefore, the child is praying and he prefers to remain within the womb rather than come out. It is said that Shukadeva Goswami, on this consideration, remained for 16 years with the womb of his mother. He did not want to be entangled in false bodily identification. After cultivating such knowledge within the womb of his mother, he came out at the end of 16 years and immediately left home, so that he might not be captured by the influence of Maya. The influence of Maya is also explained in Bhagavad Gita as insurmountable. But insurmountable Maya can be overcome simply by Krishna consciousness. That is also confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 7.14. Mam eva prapadyante maya metam turanti te. Whoever surrenders unto the lotus feet of Krishna can get out of this false conception of life by the influence of Maya only. One forgets his eternal relationship with Krishna and identifies himself with his body and the byproducts of the body, namely wife, children, society, friendship, and love. Thus he becomes a victim of the influence of Maya, and his materialistic life of continued birth and death becomes still more stringent. So you better watch out. Well, several things to discuss about this verse. One is just to repeat something from previous. It's not that every soul within the womb of their mother comes to pure consciousness. Very rare and very special. But even if one does, without the protection of the personality of Godhead, that pure consciousness again becomes covered by Maya. Real fast, like instantly. Another point related to this is a discussion that comes in Canto 11, I think it's chapter 3, towards the end. It's a discussion with Pippalayana Rishi. Maybe it's a later chapter. Pippalayana Rishi, one of the Navayogendras, and Maharishi Nimi, and there are several points there that are made to this. One is Pippalayana Rishi is describing the consciousness of the living entity while in the womb of the mother. So there's three states of consciousness with subcategories, but the three is awake, asleep and dreaming, and deep sleep. And there's Sanskrit terms for each of them. And the main point that Pippalayana Rishi is making is that the soul, even in deep sleep, is conscious that he's in deep sleep. That's his main point. So when we're awake, we're aware that we're awake. And the subtle body is functioning at its peak. That is, intelligence is operating, mind is operating, and false ego is operating. Where false ego operating means we're at the center. We're discussing this yesterday morning at Hari Nama Ashram. I'm at the center. That's the false ego. And then, of course, there's subsets of each of those. Some persons are more awake and some persons are less awake. The modes of nature are active. So when one is asleep, the senses become inert or less active. Consciousness is dulled. And so, because consciousness is dulled, consciousness is withdrawn from the senses. We're not really aware, except through hearing. We're not aware of so many things, how hot it is or cold it is, or a common example that you may take rest lying on your left side and you wake up in the morning and you're on your right side and you don't remember turning from your left side to your right side because the senses become less alert because consciousness is withdrawn. The mind, similarly, it's active, but it's not directed. And we all know what dreams are like. It's just kind of random, chaotic, don't make sense many times. And intelligence is hardly operating at all. You know, discriminating between, you know, should we turn left or right in our dream? There's emotion that's happening in the mind. Some feelings about the situation, happiness or distress or fear or joy or lust or anger or something in the mind. But the intelligence, the discrimination of the intelligence is dull. So everything becomes dulled because consciousness is reduced in sleep. But false ego is fully happening. We're at the center of the dream. This is Pippalayana Rishi's explanation. And then there's deep sleep, and there's degrees of deep sleep. It's just that there's degrees of sleep. And in deep sleep, he explains that consciousness, the subtle body becomes even less functionable And what's left is the consciousness of the soul itself. And he gives the example that when one comes out of deep sleep and to an awake state, which is very similar to what's happening here, when the child is within the womb, they're in that deep sleep state. They're not conscious, even medical science says during a certain number of months the child, you know, the living entity with whom is not conscious, and therefore in their way of thinking it justifies abortion because consciousness isn't there yet. But the consciousness is there, but in a dormant state, something like the seed. Life is there in a seed. You can have a jar of seeds sitting on your shelf. Life is inside, but is dormant. How do we know life is inside? Germinate the seed and the life comes out. Life is there, but is dormant. So similarly, consciousness during deep sleep. And deep sleep doesn't just mean like you rested well. Deep sleep, it goes further. It can include when you're not dreaming, but Prabhupada has explained, or the scriptures explain, you may be more aware of your dream or less aware of your dream, but the mind is active, but dull, meandering here and there. So consciousness becomes more awakened and you're conscious of that mental activity. But then, so when you're not conscious of the mental activity, it goes further and further and further down like anesthesia. Like anesthesia is, however it works medically, someone can cut your body and you don't feel it because you're in this deep sleep state. And when the anesthesia wears off, then you feel the pain of where they cut your body. Ouch, it hurts. So then they give you some painkiller to deal with the pain because it hurts if you want. So susupti, or deep sleep, is where you're not on the sensual plane primarily, you're not aware of what's happening. And the mind becomes dormant, the intelligence becomes dormant, even false ego becomes largely dormant. But then when you come out of that state of deep sleep, Pipalaya Rishi argues, he states, and it gives an argument to support it, that when you come out of deep sleep, you feel rested. And you say, I slept well. Something like that. It was a good rest. I slept well. Means you experience that deep sleep state. So consciousness is there, just like a living entity that's within a seed. Or the child that's within the womb. Consciousness is there, but in this susupti state. And then in the process of gestation, the living entity becomes awake. Like awake. Within the womb of the mother, and then they experience all these things and go, yikes, let me out of here. So, it's not that false ego isn't operative. Why is that important? Because here's a living entity thinking, here I am with this body, I'm at the center, I have this body. So one may be conscious of the soul, but I'm at the center. It says false ego. Now there's a detachment that this particular living entity is expressing, this detachment from the body, just like we might be detached to some degree or another, more or less detached from the body, but still false ego is operative. Although by knowledge we may know I'm the soul, I'm not the body, not fully Krishna conscious yet because we're we're not fully conscious of. That's knowledge that produces detachment, but the connection with the personality of Godhead may not be so strong. So my consciousness of Krishna may not be so strong, and so my consciousness may not be so strong. But Krishna consciousness is the cure for the material condition of life, whether in deep sleep, sleep, or awake. Nice example is Narada Muni. Narada Muni, in chapter 6 of the first canto, describes to Vyasadeva his previous life as a son of a maidservant, and how he achieved spiritual perfection during his previous life. And at the end of that life, he remembered Krishna, and at once, not like lightning and then thunder, but lightning and illumination. So there may be some time delay between you see the flash of lightning and you hear the thunder. But there's no time delay between when you see the flash of lightning and the illumination. And simultaneously, like lightning and illumination, he achieved his spiritual form. Had some discussion with some of the brahmacharis in Chicago about recently, about how do we understand that? Like, where did that... Is the spiritual form intrinsic within the soul and it just manifests, or is it from some other place and it's produced, or given, or awarded? How does it work? Not a lot of scriptural information in how it works. There's some discussion in Priti Sandarbha by Jiva Goswami that says that their spiritual form is eternal, so it's not like it's produced. And so we as spirit souls, there is a spiritual form that is us, that eternal is not produced. So there's not a lot of information on how that happens. You know, the technology of it or the procedure of it. But he manifested his spiritual form as Narada Muni, from a maidservant to Narada Muni. And, read carefully, that was the end of one of Brahma's days. So that spiritual form entered into the body of Mahavishnu. Excuse me. Garbhadakshay Vishnu. And at the end of the night of Brahma, and the next morning, the next day, Narada Muni appeared as the son of Brahma in that same spiritual form. So Narada Muni's form is a spiritual form, and thus he lives for the whole day of Brahma. That's a long time, but his form is spiritual. And his form can be seen as a spiritual form. Persons, all varieties of persons, see Narada Muni. But he didn't take on a material body. Anyways, it's a very unique situation. Narada Muni, in that state, within the abdomen of Garbhadakshay Vishnu during the night of Brahma, when the cosmic manifestation, half of it, up to above Svarga Loka was dissolved. So Narada Muni entered into the body of Garbhadakshay Vishnu and appeared directly as the son of Lord Brahma. So other living entities during that night of Brahma, or during the end of the life of Brahma, they're in that Susupti state. It's not that consciousness is snuffed out. Consciousness is suspended. Consciousness is suspended. But they're conscious because they're living entities. Living entities are eternally conscious. Just the state of consciousness called the Sukhi consciousness. Then, within the womb, then one becomes awake. It's not the false ego. Consciousness and the false ego are not existing. They're just suspended. Now then the next stage is the living entity comes out of the womb. But the language here is important. Upa sarpati in Sanskrit means Maya captures. Deva Maya susarpati captures the living entity with false identification. Mithya matihi. Mithya means false. And matihi means you consider, you identify with mithya. So the way the Prabhupada has presented this in the purport is the false egoistic consciousness of I am this body at once develops after the child comes out of the womb. So develops means it's already there, it just developed. Now it wasn't there before and then it's imposed upon the living entity. It just takes on a richer, fuller, more robust feature. False ego is with the living entity in each of the states of material consciousness, but it more fully manifests, develops. And then the rest of the language here, when it becomes entangled, Prabhupada describes how that happens. Strengthening, there was some conception here by this particular living entity within the womb of I'm not the body. But coming out of the womb of the mother, that I'm not this body, living entity, starts thinking I'm this body. So what to speak of the rest of us that think that we're the body? And then we enter into the affairs of material life, and as Prabhupada writes at the end of the purport, his materialistic life of continued birth and death becomes still more stringent. It's not like it becomes lighter. You enter into darkness and it gets darker. You go away from light and it gets darker. You continue in materialistic life and it becomes more stringent. It's a nice word, stringent, restrictive. It's something like, Prabhupada gives this example, when a prisoner is in a prison, and he tries to make an escape. He tries to not let the guards know he wants to make an escape. He tries to make an escape, and they find out. So what happens? They put more surveillance, become more stringent. Solitary confinement with three people guarding the guy because he wants to escape prison. So similarly, Prabhupada would give this example. When the living entity tries to become Krishna conscious, mind becomes more stringent. Here, it's more, she becomes more, there's more tests, more challenges. So relax. And it's not, you just don't feel it. It's not that degraded people are less confined by Maya than devotees who are trying to become Krishna conscious become confined by Maya. They're just so covered they don't even feel it. Maya will give her tests. Now here, the living entity has, you know, something like us, not within the womb trying to become Krishna conscious, but praying to Krishna to become Krishna conscious, to relieve us from this condition of a false identification. Again, some nice language in the purport. Real knowledge entails renunciation or non-acceptance of this body as the self. So the bodily conception is renounced or not accepted. I'm sorry, but I'm not going to accept it. I'm this body. I have a body, but it's not me. I can use the body, but it's not me. I don't accept the identification, but it's me. I can use the body in Krishna service, senses, mind, intelligence, gross and subtle body, in Krishna service. Thank you. But the other conception, that's me? No, thank you. So this living entity has come to that position of non-acceptance, but then, leaving the womb, accepted again. We can go from that position of conviction through knowledge, and then again become covered by the prolonged existence and false ego identifying with the body, and the reinforcements for false ego are very strong. Not just this person, that person, but the whole of the material nature is very strong. And so the cure is bhakti. Otherwise, becoming covered again is quite normal. Even when we become very firm about, I want to be Krishna conscious, material energy is very strong. Bhakti alone can overcome that. And last point is, the reference Prabhupada is making to the, in the verse, to the living entity saying, it's, previous verses is how awful the circumstances, and then the alternative of coming out of the womb of the mother, it's also fearful. So he doesn't want to come out of the womb, or doesn't want to fall prey to Maya. So Prabhupada immediately connects that with Shukadeva Goswami, who was similarly Brahman realized within the womb and decided not to leave the womb. For two reasons. It's all one. In the womb, out of the womb, doesn't matter, but it's all one. And the other was, it looks like being out of the womb is worse, Maya, than being in the womb, so I'll just stay in the womb. Vyasadeva pleaded with his son, please come out of the womb. Not until Vyasadeva, described in the Puranas, Vyasadeva walked all the way from his ashram to Dwarka to ask Krishna to come and promise his child in the womb of his wife that he'll be protected from Maya. So Krishna came and promised, you'll be protected from Maya. So he came out. But he immediately left. Prabhupada's explanation here. Immediately left because he didn't want the entanglement with mom and dad. Because, he's a pure devotee. They're pure devotees. But still, that was Shukadeva Goswami's, the extremism of his renunciation. I mean, further, he didn't even wear clothes. Clothed by the four directions, it says. Extreme renunciation. So that's not the standard. You walk around without clothes and you're totally renounce everything. Rather, he became attracted to bhakti by hearing the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. When he left, the detail is described that Vyasadeva sent some disciples to go speak messages of verses from the Bhagavatam so that Shukadeva could hear those messages of the Bhagavatam, be attracted by those messages of the Bhagavatam, lure him back to Vyasadeva's ashram so he could thoroughly instruct him in Srimad Bhagavatam. So he did. He came back and he studied under his father, sat in the classroom with the other students. And that's that question that's raised in Chapter 7 of Canto 1. Wait a minute, why did Shukadeva study this exhaustive literature, Srimad Bhagavatam? He's already self-realized. He's already there. Why do you need to study something? Learn something. Why? And the answer is because it's transcendental. It's not just learning a subject matter to get something. It was nourishing his devotional life, his love for Krishna. And he became attracted to the topics of the Ajita, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is never jita, never fallen. His wonderful activities and qualities, he became the meaning. They're all transcendental because he's not interested in anything material. That's a nice embellishment. So whether in the womb or out of the womb, conclusion, whether in the womb or out of the womb, there's danger. And we can't avoid danger without shelter of Krishna. And the best shelter of Krishna is the medium of devotional service, which is nourished by hearing about him, chanting about him, and remembering him. Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smaranam. And then other forms of devotional service in that consciousness of Krishna's shelter. Any discussion?
I was just wondering, so does this mean that the soul is not touched by Maya when it's in the womb at all? Even through indirect.
Of course, Maya is touching the soul. This is a particular unique case. This is the living entity that's come to pure consciousness while within the womb. Unique. Prabhupada doesn't emphasize that uniqueness. He doesn't say, you know, other living entities are also in Maya in the womb. They're Maya in the womb. But this particular one. But it's strengthened or it's further developed. Whether the pure consciousness, unique one, or the other ones, strengthened leaving the womb by all the activities and the affairs of material existence. Okay. Yeah.
My question has two parts. Mm-hmm. Do we have control of our consciousness, or it's given to us?
Do we have control of our
consciousness?
Consciousness.
Or it's given, like injected to us. And second part is sometimes we got influenced by other people, and sometimes we can influence them. So what determines who influences whom?
Interesting question. The first one, we don't determine our consciousness exactly. We have a role in it. But we're living entities are dependent, so we can't. Let's just say, if you could determine your consciousness, just say, okay, finish, back to Krishna Loka. You're not exclusively determining your consciousness. You have a role to play. But ultimately, that's insufficient. There's the other major missing component is the mercy of the Personality of Godhead. Now, the willingness of the Personality of Godhead is there to give every living entity full consciousness. There, so we have some choices to make, but not independent. Independently can we fulfill those choices, or dependent. It's something. Here's a visual example that works for me. Sometimes you see that a cow or some animals on a leash, a rope. There's a rope around their neck and, or somewhere, something. And the rope can be shorter or longer, but there's a rope, commonly. Especially in India, it's very common. And then they put the stake in the morning, and so the cow can eat grass within a certain circumference, depending upon the length of the rope. So the rope can be shortened or lengthened, but the cow is controlled by that. Then there may be cows that can freely graze. So it's not a perfect metaphor, but the freely grazing cow can eat grass anywhere. So similarly, Narada Muni, by his full submission to the Personality of Godhead, has unrestricted freedom. it's a contradiction, apparent contradiction. By full submission, he has full freedom. By full submission, he gave up his freedom. But now he has full freedom. Because he only operates under the will of Krishna. And that was a voluntary choice. Now he has full, unfettered freedom. The cow without a rope. Or a living entity that has unrestricted consciousness. That's Krishna consciousness. But in that condition of unrestricted consciousness, there's only one thing, the happiness of Krishna. So I've eliminated all those other things. I've restricted my freedom. Now I have maximum freedom. And then there's, you know, variations in between. So I have a role to play, but I'm not determining. And then the second question, some people influence another, and sometimes the other influences the someone, and what's the rules about who influences who? Well, on the material plane, it's guna and karma, and on the spiritual plane, it's Krishna. And Krishna's in charge of guna and karma. So again, it's who influences who, it's sanctioned by Krishna. But, so that's the ultimate rule. And then there's guna and karma. And it's very complex, guna. And karma is even more complex. So sometimes someone will influence someone, and sometimes the other person will influence that someone, you know, the first person. Depending on guna and karma, Krishna's sanction. And who can understand, you know, that the the criterion that Krishna uses during this time, this one will influence that one, and the next time that one will influence this one. Now when it comes to Krishna consciousness, then let's say a pure devotee moving about this world, a pure devotee by Krishna's power is going to influence the others. It may not look like that. Like in the case of the Pandavas and Duryodhana, look like, you know, the struggle of good against evil, and sometimes the evil was victorious or prevailing. So it looked like this one was influencing that one, but the Pandavas never lost their Krishna consciousness in any circumstance. But maybe the appearance wasn't the reality. The reality was they were fully protected in their Krishna consciousness, and ultimately prevailed. So there may be a drama involved in who is influencing whom, but for the devotees, they're protected by Krishna. They will influence others. Now, let's step back from that and say, here we are, it's Kali Yuga. And within this age of Kali, there's a certain, by Krishna's plan, there's a certain set of characteristics of Kali Yuga described in the Bhagavatam. And that's going to happen because that's part of the sanction of Krishna. Now within that, so there's a prevailing deterioration of good qualities. At the same time, here comes a pure devotee in the midst of Kali Yuga, or Lord Chaitanya comes, or the associates of Lord Chaitanya come, and they can influence the victims of Kali Yuga. Now still people have to say yes, they can say no. But if they say yes, then they become influenced by that pure devotee, but some persons don't become influenced by that pure devotee. They become offensive. Then they get more cover. Guna and karma and Krishna and the bearers of Krishna's wishes, Krishna's will. You have something?
How do we know that we are pleasing Krishna?
Louder.
How do we know that we are pleasing
Krishna? How do we know what?
We are pleasing Krishna.
How do we know if we're pleasing Krishna? He'll smile. He's smiling.
How do we please Krishna?
By following his instructions, and instructions include following his representatives. The instructions, those are carrying Krishna's instructions, follow their instructions with devotion and love. That's pleasing Krishna. Okay, so the Prabhupada came.